Good morning, everyone. It's July 17th, and we're about to start our planning board meeting. Before we begin with our business items, I just want to acknowledge that today across the country, we honor the legacy of Congressman John Lewis. In addition to his many great works and accomplishments, he had many great sayings. One of the many of them that really resonate with me is the one that says, when you see something that's not right, not fair, not just, you have to speak up, you have to say something, you have to do something. So that really, really resonates with me. He pushed to accomplish great city, you know, great cities across, communities across the country because of his great accomplishments and great works, and I really appreciate that. So I wanted to put that out there first, and now we can begin our business portion of our meeting. We start with preliminary matters. The first is adoption of resolutions. We have two this morning. The first is 8676 Georgia Avenue Preliminary Plan Amendment, and the second is 8676 Georgia Avenue Site Plan. Do I have a motion for approval?
Move to approve the resolutions.
Oh, I'm sorry. On this one, Commissioner Petum cannot.
I second.
Vote. Gracious, he's absent. I'm sorry.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. 401. I'm sorry. Commissioner Linden is online this morning.
Hello.
Sorry about that, Commissioner Linden. Welcome. So 401. The next is Commissioner Petum can vote on. This is the Pepco Norbeck Substation Forest Conservation Plan Amendment and the 6000 Executive Boulevard Sketch Plan Amendment. Do I have a motion for approval of these two resolutions?
Yeah, move to approve the resolutions.
I second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. The ayes have it, 5-0. The next is approval of minutes. We have one this morning, the minutes of July 10th, 2025. Do I have a motion for approval?
Yeah, move to approve the minutes from July 10th.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. The ayes have it, 5-0. And the next is there's a second corrected resolution and memo for Montgomery Auto Parks Lot 18 Site Plan Amendment, where all commissioners are available to vote. Do I have a motion for approval of this corrected resolution?
Yeah, move to approve the corrected resolution.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The ayes have it, 5-0. Next, we have regulatory extension requests. There are three this morning. The Big Woods Manor Administrative Subdivision Plan and Preliminary/Final Forest Conservation Plan Extension Request Number 3. The second is Alta Vista Gardens, Lot 9, Block A Administrative Subdivision Extension Request Number 2. And the last is Primrose at 16550 Georgia Avenue Preliminary Plan Regulatory Extension Request Number 3. Do I have a motion for approval of these extension requests?
Yeah, move to approve the extension requests.
I second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 The ayes have it, 5-0. And next, we will have our roundtable discussion with our planning director, Jason Sartori. Welcome, Mr. Sartori.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. So you're not going to hear too much from me this morning. I'm just going to give I'm going to focus mostly on our personnel update at the end. And just give a quick highlight of things that are going to be coming in the next few weeks before we go into recess. So I'm going to mostly hand over my report today to our team that's working on our development pipeline analysis project to give you all an update on where things are with that. So just real quickly to highlight some of the things that are coming up, some important items that we have over the next few weeks. Today, we're really excited for our single stair building presentation to get a sense of what that could potentially mean for development and housing here in Montgomery County and what we need to do to be able to advance ideas around that. Next week, we have the workforce housing. ZTA will be before the full council, and so we're looking forward to that work session that obviously in some ways advances some of the ideas and things that we've been talking about for many years through Thrive and through Attainable Housing Study, Attainable Housing Initiative. And so we're looking forward to that as well. And then the following week, the full council will be taking up the incentive zoning ZTA, which we've brought through the board, but obviously you know is a result of our work on the benefit public benefit point system revisions and updates. At the end of the month, for your last board meeting before you go into recess, we will be giving a briefing, joining the Montgomery County Economic Development Corporation, giving a briefing to you all on the most recent quarter, the second quarter economic indicators. And this is something that we do every quarter with the MCEDC and present to the council. This particular one has generated a lot of interest beyond the council office building and here. And so I think it'll, in particular, when it comes to the amount of development activity that we've been seeing over the last couple of quarters. And so we're looking forward to having that conversation with you all at the end of the month. And then lastly, I just want to highlight that ongoing throughout the summer, our beta cohort that is helping us test the Community Planning Academy system that we and program that we've put in place, they're continuing to go through that. We've received some really outstanding feedback from the people who are participating in this and the modules that they've completed. We're feeling really good about it, and we're looking forward to continuing to kind of modify that as we look to roll it out completely to the community in the fall. I will say just last night, our team, led by Bridget Breuer, Khalid Afzal, and Chris Pfeiffer, presented to the county's Racial Equity and Social Justice Advisory Committee to get give them an update on how that's going and to get their feedback and thoughts, and that went really well as also. So, you know, even though it's the summer and we're still very active and really excited about the work that we're doing. And so with that, though, I'm going to hand it over to Kayla to go through the development pipeline analysis project. And really, I mean, this is another thing that we'll be actively working on over the course of the next few weeks, too. So,
before she goes, Dr. Sartori, I just want to say I'm really sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
I know it's very, very difficult. And I just want you to know that our prayers and our heart, from I'm saying it from all of us, are with you and happy to see you back. And I know that the smile that you have on your face, behind it, you have a broken heart.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate to have you here to do that. And I'm really looking forward to a few things that you're going to bring it for us before end of this year, before the summer break. So hopefully we're going to be there and asking all the questions. So thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. For those who don't know, my sister-in-law passed away last week. And while it's been really, it was unexpected and it's been really tough, there is one kind of slight slimmer of silver lining was that she was an organ donor, and I am now, I'm an organ donor myself, but I'm suddenly a really strong advocate for it because as hard as it was for us, the idea that she is actually saving three people's lives at the moment, and the unimaginable joy that those families must have knowing that their family member is going to be able to be okay because of the donation is just really amazing. And so I encourage people, you don't think about it when you sign up for your driver's license, but I definitely encourage people to be organ donors.
I'm also an organ donor, and the way I feel about it is that pieces of her are still alive.
Absolutely.
So she's not dead.
Thank you.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Kayla Prendergast for the record. So as Jason said, I'm here today to just give a little update of what we've been working on with the development pipeline analysis. To get us started, you know, I'm sure everybody knows this, but just to make sure we're all on the same page, speaking the same language, the development pipeline is a database, our internal database of projects in the county that have received regulatory approval but have not yet been built. And also, as many of you know, regulatory approval does not guarantee that a project will move forward, and many projects will stall or change after receiving approval, and some may never actually break ground at all. So as of right now, the pipeline data that we are working with includes 278 development projects, which are a combination of residential, commercial, and mixed-use projects. These projects account for just under 30,000 unbuilt housing units, and this includes projects that are both fully unbuilt and projects that are partially built. In terms of the analysis that we've been working on, it's part of, you know, larger ongoing efforts to monitor housing delivery, evaluate development trends, and support policy decisions related to housing production. The analysis is going to help us better understand how approved units are making it to construction, why some may be delayed, as well as, you know, think about how we share information about the pipeline and how we're reporting on that information. The analysis at this stage is focusing specifically on residential and mixed-use projects that already have approvals, and there are two primary data sources that we're using. First, on the quantitative side, we're looking at each project's development history through approvals and amendments, as well as units built. Second, we are looking to gather on-the-ground insights through a developer survey, as well as follow-up interviews with those developers to gather more context about what's happening on the ground, what barriers developers are facing, and, you know, kind of what they think might unlock progress. Also, sort of separately from these two kind of main data sources, we're also doing a scan of how other jurisdictions are tracking and talking about their pipeline data, which may improve or which may inform how we improve our own reporting moving forward. So now to dive into some of those preliminary results, we'll start with a look at the quantitative analysis side. So first, just looking at, you know, kind of the simple but really not so simple, as you all know, results related to how long projects have been on the pipeline, looking at both time since their original approval, which are the red bars, and most recent original approval dates in blue and most recent approval dates in red. As you can see, nearly 80% of projects received their most recent approval less than 5 years ago, and on average across all projects, there's a recent approval date of around 4 or 3.8, to be specific, years ago. Still, though, this graph shows that there are projects that have stalled in their delivery. 17 projects were first approved, that's the blue bar on the far right, over 20 years ago, and though many, with the exception of two, have been amended since then, these 19 projects still exist on the pipeline, meaning that they have not been delivered fully.
So, no, if something has been there for 20 years, and actually even, you know, I would say after 10 years, what is the possibility of them coming back? I think it makes sense that we just scratch them. I don't know, but, you know, after talking to the developers and take them out of the pipeline, because it creates...
What we have here is that older, those really old ones didn't have expirations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so when you see, like, there's none in the 15 to 19 year period, that's probably because we started having the expirations, and so those have expired, but the older ones have not because they don't expire. Mm-hmm. And on occasion, we will have one of these old ones that do come forward and suddenly is ready to go.
Now, that would be a bonus, right. But let's get to be more real. That's fine. I'm not saying that we don't let them build. Right. If they come, that's a bonus, you know, and we would be very happy. But realistically, you know.
No.
Yeah. I think what you'll see in the coming slides is what we're gathering in terms of the likelihood of some of these projects moving forward. And as we gather more of those data, then I think we can even disaggregate it by years since original approval. And we might find that, yeah, the ones that are the oldest are the ones that are most likely to not.
So maybe, yeah. I don't know how much more you have to present. I want you to present it all. Yeah. Please present it all, and maybe we can ask questions after.
I want to come back to the 15, 19 years and the difference between empirical data and communications. So.
I was going to ask a question.
Yeah.
So,
we can come back to any of these slides.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Mitra touched on it about these the lack of construction. Is there any teeth to force somebody to build after it's been approved? And is there any penalty? Do they pay bonds that can't be repaid? Or
why don't you pin that question? They're going to answer that question, but please, why don't you just go through your presentation? Thanks. And so, because because I know you have more questions, but let's see the entirety, okay?
Yeah, thank you. This slide, I think, gets at an important point to remember about the pipeline, which is that just because a project remains on the pipeline does not mean that it has made absolutely no progress towards build out. And I think that's something that sort of gets lost when we talk about like the project numbers, like in the last slide. This chart shows that many of the projects with the longest time since their most recent approval have the highest build-out rates. So you'll see that 71% with recent approvals between 10 and 14 years ago have been built, compared to just 24% of the projects with more recent approvals. This isn't obviously necessarily surprising, as we all know how long it takes to build out a project. But when talking about the pipeline as a whole, as I said, I think this nuance gets lost a little bit. But still, you know, across all projects, there are still 30,000 or 68% of units yet to be built. So this slide breaks down the information in the previous slide a little bit further to look at the geographic splits of built and approved units using the new regional planning areas. As you can see, UpCounty in green has the highest delivery overall, with nearly half of units built for projects with recent approvals in the last 4 years, and 97% build out for projects that were recently approved 10 to 14 years ago. And kind of in all these categories, East and West County lag both in approved units and delivery. But again, the farther back you go, the more build out you see. This slide breaks it down a little bit more again to look at the splits between single family and multifamily, with single family in red and multifamily in green. In the units that were approved 0 to 4 years ago, multifamily units make up the bulk of approvals, but despite that, a larger share of single-family units get built sooner, with over half that were approved in the last 4 years being built, compared to just 19% of multifamily units. By 10 to 14 years out, 96% of approved single-family units have been built, and multifamily build-out also improves with age, but still lags a bit behind single-family at 59% build-out after 10 to 14 years. One thing that has been flagged for us here and that we're hoping to look into a little bit more is to further break this down to include townhouses and how that's changed between amendments. So you'll see that in our next step slide to dig more into this into the next phase of the analysis.
Yeah, I remember that page, but we need to come back. Okay,
so that was just like a kind of a high level of what we've been working on so far on the qualitative side. And, you know, obviously we're still digging into it, but, you know, just wanted to give you a little taste of what we've done so far. On the qualitative side, like I said, we'll chat a little bit about the survey. So in May, we started the outreach effort for the survey to better understand which projects are likely to move forward, focusing on residential and mixed-use developments with 10 or more unbuilt units. We used contacts assigned to each project and emailed a short questionnaire to 88 of the qualifying projects, which captures just over 29,000 of the roughly 30,000 total unbuilt units in the pipeline, so the majority. So far, we've received 36 responses and are continuing to follow up. Actually, just a few days ago, we met with a development consultant that gave us more intel on 10 additional projects. So this information will be updated as soon as we have time to categorize that. The survey asked about potential timelines, barriers to progress, what factors would help move things forward, and we'll get into some of the key takeaways from those responses in the next few slides. So first, again, starting off with the simple and not so simple, the survey asked whether the unbuilt units associated with each project are actively advancing towards development. As you can see in the chart, 32% of the unbuilt units across responding projects are reported to not be advancing. That means that over two-thirds of the unbuilt units, more than 4,500, are advancing. At the project level, this is 15 projects not moving forward out of the 36 that have responded thus far. Again, digging in a little more, we asked each respondent to report on their level of project activity using the categories you see here: treading water, not active, full speed ahead, etc.
Yeah, the nautical.
Credit to Alex there. And I'll note that not every project has responded to every question, so the percentages are based on the number of respondents to each specific question. So for this question, just under 40% selected full speed ahead, meaning they're committing all necessary resources to move the project forward. About 16% reported no activity, and another 16% said the project is on life support. Smaller share, around 12% said that they're treading water, and 9% selected a cautious advance. A few selected other and provided additional context in open-ended responses. It's worth noting, I think, that some of the projects that answered in the previous question that they weren't advancing, selected in this question that they are still at least committing some resources, which suggests a difference between projects that are inactive and those that are like stalled but not totally abandoned. And then finally, the last question that we'll go over here today asked about key impediments to project completion. So the results here show that the top barrier identified was financial, specifically that the pro forma no longer pencils out. This was followed by rising construction costs, technical property-specific issues, as well as local policies. A number of responses also referenced equity financing and programmatic changes, with some lower-ranked issues like market demand and changes in ownership cited less often. The survey included a total of 12 questions with opportunities to expand on answers and provide written feedback as well. And like I said, we're also doing interviews as a follow-up with the developers to get even more information on, you know, kind of the why here. And then just quickly for next steps on the quantitative side, we're obviously going to continue to dig deeper into the data. Like I said, one thing we've heard from multiple developers is that townhouses are often the only high-density product that pencils out right now, so we're kind of going to go back and trace some of the changes that we've seen through the amendment process and then specifically pull out townhouses to identify that trend. And then we're going to, to that point, look at how density changes over time, comparing the original approvals to amendments, and expand the analysis to include more of these original approval data points for context. On the survey side, like I said, we still have a chunk of projects we haven't heard from yet. We're doing direct follow-up. We're working with our regulatory planners to help with that outreach, and have also offered to, with the developer that we met this week, this worked, just offer to meet with them if they don't have time to fill out the survey, to just have the discussion as opposed to having them fill out the survey. And then I think, you know, just the bottom line, we're trying to round out the story so we have a full picture of what's going on and can better tailor our final report and recommendations. I think that's all. So, questions?
Yeah. Thank you so much for your deep dive into the data and what you've already gotten. This is a trailer of hopefully for what's going to come soon. It's really important that this was really an important project to undertake, and I really thank you for really pushing to get this data. So thank you for that. So let me let the other board members ask their questions now that they've seen the full picture.
Okay. How much time do we have to go into mixed methods research? All right. I did want to go. So the gap that we have at the 15 to 19 year range is roughly, I'm doing the math, and I'm assuming it's about 2006 to 2010, so surrounding the housing crisis. Did we notice a slowdown in approvals at that time? Is it as much the housing crisis as it is? Is it approvals? Is it the change in the time of the, you know, having a end date included in those? And so I just like It's interesting to have a gap that large and that nothing. And I'm just and that indicates a policy change of some type.
I think that we haven't actually looked at the approval data yet, but it's on our kind of list of
things. Okay, yeah, I was wondering because that's the that's right on the housing crisis.
The other thing I would just highlight is that when a project is completed, it comes off of that.
It comes off that list.
So there, it's not that projects weren't completed, and Alex.
Oh, of course, no information on that too.
But just some of those have they've been completed, so they're no longer on the pipeline.
Yeah, that was and that's the thing. Yeah, we're selecting on whether or not it's there or not, and that's the difference. It's just it's interesting to have a gap that large and that not anything in there. And there is possibly a possibility of both the policy change and a very large exogenous shock.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time going back and checking after I discovered.
Oh yeah, no, that's one of those ones that I would do a huge deep dive on in a rabbit hole, and somebody would come to me 3 days later and ask where I've been, trying to figure out why that is. I said one on the region and the size of the project, or the region and the type of the project, single family versus multifamily. We had the up, I think it was 10. And I think you went into it a little bit, I think, on the next slide, but the approval by region. So we switched it to our new regions, right? So our east, our west, and our north. And like, are we seeing the single family in the up county, and that's why we're seeing that disparity is what that is? Is that is a distinguishing between the type of project?
Short answer. I think in the larger report we'll have like more detail more on like those on splits specifically.
But yeah, I was just the up county and that meant lower approvals, higher percentages, all that kind of stuff. I was just curious on that. And then the I can probably ask these questions offline. I did want to go in with the overwhelming response on why they didn't complete project was financing. And that's pretty obvious. That's what we hear. We know that. We see that. And it's various types of different types of financing. But we also have local policies on there, which covers a lot. And these were selected by us, and they were picked from a list from them. This is not open response. And you may be going into this with the surveys and interviewing people, but is there a second order effect from the type of the policies leading to financing issues? Are we hearing that? Is that coming in through any of the data? Like, you know, we've heard media reports, but are we getting that from the survey and the interview data?
Yeah. Alex Pemberton, for the record, Research and Strategic Projects. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of leading up the qualitative side in the interviews with developers and consultants. We have heard that there's a connection there. Mm-hmm. I think what we want to note is what you're seeing on the top line here, and it's good to remember that, Kayla, correct me if I'm wrong, about 70% of our units on the pipeline are multifamily units. Yeah. Financing for multifamily units has changed drastically in the last 3 years. And so a lot of what you're seeing with that slowdown is purely a matter of economics and the cap rate expansion that we've seen. We have heard in our qualitative interviews, the ones that we've conducted so far, that there are local policy issues, and we're trying to dive into that a little bit more in a holistic way before we sort of, categorize the responses to that.
Okay, and of course, I just wanted to see if there was any preliminary in there. And then I had one more question, and we take the rest of this offline. But the debt financing and the equity financing being that close together, is there anything that you've got so far, any preliminaries, why there's not more separation between those two? Because one is typically easier than the other. But I'm curious as to why those are so close and why did we decide to separate them out just to begin with? We have like sort of...
Could you explain the difference between those two for people like me who don't understand?
I will defer and get answers to my question. But yes,
yeah, I'll happily explain that. So equity financing in a real estate project is the financing that the ownership group brings to the project. So typically a developer will bring maybe 10% of the project. Another 20, 30, 40% of the project will be from investors. And that's cash. And it's at-risk money. They lose it if the project goes south. They will then leverage their cash with debt financing from a bank or an institution. That is less risky. It's a lower rate of interest, and that gets paid back first. So we wanted to separate that out to Commissioner Hedrick's point. we wanted to separate that out to see if there was a difference, if there was a gap. Because we know that these markets for debt and equity capital are correlated, but they work a little bit differently. Yeah. What we've found so far is that it's close, and I think what we've heard and what we know from what's going on in the market generally is that these follow each other. So the equity tends to be really excited when they know that they can get debt capital, when they know that they have a smooth path to realizing their investment. So that's what we think. But again, we're still getting into the interviews and trying to nail that down.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see that separated out in a public survey. The information is public. You can sometimes find it by digging deeper into like information from proprietary sources. But I thought that was interesting. It was interesting both to separate it out and that they were so close, because they are correlated but can be, particularly in affordable housing, very different types of markets. Mm-hmm. And I'm more familiar with that than I am with private. But anyway, this has really got them really interested to see what you come up with for the last part of it. Thank you.
One of the things I is hopefully over time you could figure out which, yes, some are not moving forward but are any close, and what would take those few close ones over the top, right? So maybe there's some, I don't know if they're willing to talk to you, you know, maybe it's just a small amount sometimes, mm-hmm. that would take a couple of those, say 10 or 15 or three, and within to get some moving. So if it'd be interesting as you dig deeper with them, would they be willing to talk about that? Because that's also part of what we were looking at. Mm-hmm. The other is, we always, as you guys always do a great job, how does our jurisdiction compare with a neighboring jurisdiction? Mm-hmm. Are they having a hard, are as many as a percent not getting built as ours? Well, I know our county is much different in many ways because we have more of an urban core, suburban core, and more of a rural core. And many our neighboring jurisdictions aren't quite like us, but I'd be interested to see how are other jurisdictions doing as compared to ours. Those are the you may not be able to find, but maybe you will be able to find.
Yeah, we've started the jurisdiction scan. I think from a preliminary scan, it's just, the way that they're talking about it is different too. Like that, the 30,000 unbuilt units, they don't have that kind of big number out there. They provide a lot more nuance typically when they're talking about the data. So something that we will consider in our final.
Okay. All right, thank you. So this is wonderful. Keep going.
No, I have more.
Oh, okay, okay.
I have more questions. Sorry. I think when you look at the neighboring county, I understand they don't have it. I think we should go to the ones that developers, we keep hearing that they're going there. Yeah. Okay. Maybe Howard County, Frederick County, mm-hmm. and some of the sister or brother counties in Virginia mm-hmm. that are very similar to us, to see that what local policies that they don't have or they have that is helping the developers and encouraging them to go there. The other question that I have is that it's something that, again, I keep hearing, that we look at single-family housing. Our understanding is that we are, changing our zoning that allow more different kind than single family. So if in a few years, in future, the number of single families are going down, it may be a good thing if the number of multifamily or townhouses go up, okay? But if single family is going down, and multifamily or townhouses are not going out, or duplexes or triplexes, then there is something going on. The other thing that you just said it yourself is it's townhouses. It looks to me that people are more interested to have individual units that they have more control over it. If you think about multifamilies, people don't want to purchase condos anymore. So multifamily is for rental, okay? So if someone wants to
own a unit, it's versus, you know, duplex, triplex, or townhouses, or single family. If townhouses are more affordable, then people after the rental, they try to save their money and they come to the townhouses. So it looks like that the market is maybe hot for townhouses, especially if you are not at the core of, you know, urban area like Bethesda or Silver Spring or Wheaton that is very close to the metro centers. And everywhere else, people say, well, you know, we don't have that easiness of having public transportation, so we want to own our own house. So owning our own house, it just gives us the option of, you know, single is expensive unless we go very far out, but there is no transportation, so we're going to settle to townhouse. And I believe that, and I have heard also from a lot of other developers that, especially in a little bit further when you go to up county or sometimes even in the east county, townhouses are hotter than multifamily. So this is something that has to do with the market and not with policies or anything. Is well, it does have to policy because we're changing the policies, but the market drives it to where it should be. So I like to see that how this market would impact these pipelines, especially if it is single family. If single family is in the pipeline and they are not building it, maybe townhomes would do it for them.
Yeah.
Something
so,
like that.
Yeah. So when you come back, we'd love to hear more about this.
Okay.
And I'm delighted that Commissioner Pedewin is really, really, really interested in this. And so when you do your final presentation, we're going to take the whole day.
Yeah. actually, the presentation on 7/31. I sent you copies from the Montgomery perspective. That was very interesting.
Yeah.
So this is something that I'm really looking for.
And we have Commissioner Linden. Let me ask this question, and we have to move on. So thank you, Commissioner Linden.
Yeah, thanks. Just really quick. Well, thanks for this initial presentation. Really interesting look at the preliminary data. A couple of things that I think could be really useful to sort of disaggregate in a little bit more detail when we get to the final stage of this is first, just maybe a little more geographic specificity. I understand that we're, you know, grouping these into our new planning regions, and I get that makes sense in a number of ways. But I think it could also be interesting to sort of, you know, look more specifically at different markets, because we know that different markets attract different types of projects, and that might impact different levels of feasibility for different product types. So that's one thing that I think could be an interesting add-on when we get to that final stage. And the other thing is, and you got into this a little bit when looking at, for example, projects that did move forward, or sort of the percentage of projects that did move forward in the different timeframe buckets. I think it could be really useful for us to understand sort of, or to see a little bit more detail about comparisons. So for example, within each timeframe bucket, so 0 to 4, 5 to 9, 10 to 14, apparently not 15 to 19, as Commissioner Hendricks said, but within those buckets, you know, comparing the projects that did move forward to building permit, and the projects that didn't, and what are the characteristics associated with each? So, you know, could be project size in terms of number of units, the geographic location, the types of public benefits that were associated with it, the number of other kind of adequate public facility costs that were associated with the projects. And I'm sure you can think of, you know, quite a few others that could be interesting. But I think that comparison look of projects that did move forward and projects that didn't could also help us understand a little bit more about kind of how policy and how other factors may relate to those different trajectories. So that's that was what I immediately thought of when looking through this. And I'm not sure if that's possible to do that kind of across the board, but maybe even if it's not, and I totally understand if, you know, time frame constraints, maybe even just a couple of case studies about projects that did versus projects that didn't, and what can we kind of glean from that? What does that tell us about potential implications? So, but I really appreciate the work. This is really good work so far, and thanks for presenting. Good luck moving forward with it.
Well, this is all really helpful feedback as we try to kind of move forward with this effort and kind of wrap things up with the intention of being able to present to the council our findings in the fall. And certainly we'll have recommendations in there about, you know, what might be some things that could kind of spur some of these things to move along. I will say the geographic specificity, I think, is something we will definitely look at as we gather more and get more information. We'll be able to provide that. The specifically looking at projects that have successfully been completed, I think there'll be some that'll be a little bit more difficult. I think it's a different data set. Those projects are no longer in the pipeline, so we now need to do kind of a little bit more digging in a different way to find those projects that have been completed. But we can talk about how we can try to get at least some case studies, as you were mentioning, Commissioner Linden. So with that, I just want to thank both Alex and Kayla and Lisa Gavoni, who's online, and others from our Housing Infrastructure and Zoning team and our Research and Strategic Projects Division, who've been actively working on this a lot over the last few weeks, and we'll continue to make progress.
And when you do, and I remember Commissioner Bartley's initial question was around, should, you know, the carrot and the stick, how do you, you can, when you, in your recommendations, maybe you can talk through that, you know, should you keep it?
Certainly. I mean, that's when I was mentioning that we'll have some recommendations on that, that it could be a little bit of both. And I think that there's certainly interest from certain council members already to try to, they're looking to this to get some ideas of what could potentially help.
Thank you.
Okay, so on the personnel front, just a few quick updates. You all know Audrey Vogel as a member of our UpCounty Planning Division, having led the Damascus Placemaking Festival last year and co-leading the Germantown Sector Plan Amendment. Audrey has been promoted to a Planner 3 in our West County Planning Division, where she will be working on master plan efforts, including the Friendship Heights Sector Plan, as well as other upcoming studies and plans. So congratulations to Audrey. Russell Corbin will be starting this coming Monday. He will be joining the Information Services team, which is now part of our Communications and Engagement Division, as a Planner 1. Russell was a summer intern for planning in 2023, and we're happy to welcome him back on a full-time basis. So he'll be working at the information counter down here. And then lastly, we have two new interns that I wanted to introduce that will be working with us through this month. Diego Zuniga is a Management Services Division intern. He is a rising senior at Salisbury University. He's working with our budget manager, Amber Ford. He's creating the FY27 budget development workbooks for our divisions, and he's validating and updating the Development Review Special Revenue Fund memo. And Malcolm English is a summer intern in the director's office. He's working on documenting urban design street precedents throughout the county. This fall, he'll be a senior at Our Lady of Good Counsel High School. He tells us he's interested in studying architecture or engineering in college, and so hopefully he'll get a little bit of exposure to see where he wants to go with his future. So we welcome both Diego and Malcolm, and we're happy to have all of our interns here and seeing that they're doing things that are really helpful to the work that we do at the planning department. So with that, if there are any other questions, happy to answer them. Otherwise, we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Thank you so much for your presence. Always interesting, always learning. The board gives the board opportunities to learn and understand more about what you're doing. And also congratulations and welcome to the new employees, the interns, and those that have received promotions. So thank you so much. We're going to take a two-minute break and then start with our next item, item number 5, Sangfroid Distilling Subdivision Waiver and Site Plan, where staff is recommending approval with conditions. Thank you. Good morning. We're on item number 5, Sang Froid Distilling Subdivision Waiver Number SRW 2025-02 and Site Plan Number 8 2025-0060, where staff is recommending approval with conditions and adoptions of resolutions. So this morning we have Grace Bogdan from the Planning Department presenting this item. Welcome.
Good morning, members of the Planning Board. Grace Bogdan, lead reviewer for Sang Froid Distilling. This is a subdivision waiver and a site plan for an existing historic bank in Tacoma Park, where we are recommending approval of each of the applications with conditions. This map on your screen orients you to where Tacoma Park is in the property. It abuts DC along the eastern border. And then on this slide, the aerial shows the subject property highlighted in the red dashed line. The property is comprised of 3 lots of record, lots 1, 2, and 4. The property is split zone, so lots 1 and 2, which front on Carroll Avenue at the corner of Willow Avenue, are zoned NR 0.75 with a height of 50 feet. And then lot 4 in the rear, which fronts on Willow Avenue, is zoned CRT 0.75 with a height of 50 feet. All of the lots in the subject property are also within the Tacoma Park East Silver Spring Commercial Revitalization Overlay Zone. They're also within the National Register Historic District and the Tacoma Park Historic District. The site totals 0.38 tract acres. And on the aerial, you can begin to see the existing conditions of the site. There is that existing bank building at the corner of Carroll Avenue and Willow Avenue. And in its existing state, the bank straddles the property line between lots 1 and 2. So just a little bit of background as to how we got here today. The lots 1, 2, and 4 were created by record plat back in 1902. This is the Lipscomb and Ernest Trustees plat. And then shortly after, the bank was constructed in 1927 over those lot lines that separate lots 1 and 2. The bank has existed for quite some time. I think it was most recently operated as Bank of America. And then the property changed ownership in 2021 and again in 2023 to the current property owners, who purchased the property to use it as an adaptive reuse for a distillery and tasting room. So they took that proposal to the Historic Preservation Commission in 2023 for a historic area work permit, which was received in 2024. And then they moved forward to the Department of Permitting Services in 2024 for the addition, where they found out that due to the existing condition of the bank crossing the lot line, as well as being located within the Tacoma Park East Silver Spring Overlay Zone, that the existing historic bank is 35 feet in height. The overlay zone limits height to 30 feet, so it's a non-conforming bank. Therefore, they are required to provide a site plan for the addition, given its non-conforming nature. So,
I have a question about non-conforming in nature. The bank height in the building existed prior to the regulation, correct?
That's correct.
So if it existed prior to the regulation, it seems almost punitive to make someone go through the site plan because it's over the regulated height when it existed prior. And so I just find it curious that you'd make a landowner and an entrepreneur who's taken a significant risk to go through this process when the building and its height previously existed. It's curious to me.
Understandable. There are certain provisions in the zoning code that allow historic structures to move forward. Those have to be publicly owned. Unfortunately, given the circumstances of this, there was no way around the site plan. We tried. We looked. We also offered opportunities in other circumstances to put forward a zoning text amendment. That was not moved forward with, and so unfortunately the only way to move forward with the existing requirements of the code is through a site plan. So the first application under consideration for the board today is the subdivision waiver request. And the applicant is requesting the board to waive the requirement of Chapter 50, which would require a preliminary plan to be approved prior to recordation of plat. And allowing the subdivision waiver would essentially allow the applicants to record a record plat that would consolidate lots 1 and 2 where the existing bank crosses the internal lot lines. Lot 4 would remain a separate lot in the rear of the property. During the review of this, the applicant did propose to dedicate a right-of-way along Willow Avenue to achieve the master planned right-of-way of 60 feet. However, this is the city of Tacoma Park, and they had stated that they have no need for this additional right-of-way. And so lots 1 and 2 will be consolidated for a total of 9,360 feet. For the site plan portion of the application, it is for that addition in the rear of the building, 987 square feet addition to the existing building. The applicant is proposing to do other site improvements to the property, most notably in the rear where that existing parking lot is. There is a great deal of impervious area, and so they are proposing to remove close to 2,000 square feet of impervious area and replant that with perennials, shrubs, and an herb garden for the proposal. And the applicant is also proposing to make ADA improvements throughout the property from the parking lot to the building as well. This slide here shows the access and circulation. In its existing condition, there are access points off of Willow Avenue and Carroll Avenue. Willow Avenue allows in and outs and exit only onto Carroll Avenue. The applicant is not proposing to change these access points. And then the main pedestrian access point to the building fronts on Carroll Avenue. And again, the applicant will be improving accessibility throughout the site, and they will be expanding sidewalks along Willow Avenue to be 6 feet in width. So for the board to grant a subdivision waiver, the applicant must submit the request in writing and be reviewed by the Development Review Committee and any appropriate agencies prior to Planning Board consideration. The applicant did that and also included City of Tacoma Park, given they have purview over the stormwater and the city streets. And then to approve a subdivision waiver request, the board must find that due to practical difficulty or unusual circumstances of the plan, the application of the specific requirement of Chapter 50 is not required to ensure public health, safety, and general welfare. In this circumstance, it's the practical difficulty of the existing layouts and the improvements on site. The structure and the lots in this condition have existed since the early 1920s, and all existing improvements for access to public roads and utilities are in place. The property does not fit under any criteria in Chapter 50 for minor subdivisions or administrative subdivisions, because these really are specific to residential properties or uses. Given the commercial use and nature of this site, it is not allowed to go under a shorter process. And secondly, the intent of the requirement is still met. The subdivision waiver has been reviewed by all agencies within the Development Review Committee and the City of Tacoma Park. The intent of a preliminary plan is to coordinate facilities with existing and planned facilities, such as dedicated right-of-way, making adequate public facilities determination, and ensure protection of natural resources. Through the review, all agencies found that this, due to the limited scope, a full preliminary plan would not be required. And the other smaller things have already begun review through the site plan and the building permit process. And lastly, the waiver is the minimum necessary to provide relief from the requirements. This is the minimum necessary. We're only consolidating lots 1 and 2. Lot 4 will remain as is, and the application will remain in conformance with the remaining criteria for the record plat approvals. And then lastly, this is consistent with the purposes and objectives of the general plan. Thrive 2050 encourages concentrated growth in centers of activity through compact infill development. And they also set forth goals for strengthening Montgomery County's economic competitiveness, promoting environmental health, encouraging urbanism. This adaptive reuse of the former bank building into a distillery will enhance the historic district and offer economic benefits and support job creation. This adaptive reuse aligns with broader trends in economic development that prioritize creative, experience-based commercial spaces, particularly those that celebrate local culture, craft production, and community engagement. The limited scope of the project, both in scale and footprint, further minimizes disruption to the surrounding environment, and the proposed improvements, though limited in scope, reflect an intentional effort to modernize infrastructure in a resilient and climate-conscious manner consistent with the general plan. So with that, staff does find that the applicant has met all noticing and signage requirements and satisfy all criteria in the zoning ordinance and subdivision ordinance. The applicant did receive an FCP exemption for the site plan application, and the applications have received all necessary approvals from the city and reviewing agencies. Therefore, we recommend approval of the subdivision waiver and site plan with conditions and adoption of the resolutions.
Thank you for your presentation. Very understandable. I am supportive of the subdivision waiver, but I just have a couple questions. One, if the applicant was not adding on the 925 square feet, but was only getting a building permit for the interior renovation, would they have had to come for this waiver?
They would have. There's a requirement in Chapter 50 that a building permit can only be issued for a building in a manner that is located entirely on one lot.
Okay. So when this was built, you could be located on more than one lot, but now the law changed, so a building needs to be on one lot.
That's correct.
Okay. So just thinking, we don't have to discuss a lot here, but maybe these are some things that we should put on the parking lot list of maybe amendments or ZTAs or things that can we can work on to prevent in the future from projects having to do this. It would save time, it would save money, I think. And so we can talk about it as a team, you know, with the planning, because our goal is to make the process faster and make it less expensive for people that want to build and, you know, and create businesses in the county. So I think that let's put that on the parking lot to discuss in the future and see what we can do. Also, I had a question about this City of Tacoma Park is not requiring dedication. Is any land is dedicated along Willow? They don't foresee any dedication for widening of Willow, or just out of curiosity, no other properties have dedicated or?
So Willow Avenue, as it travels north, it becomes a residential area. So they probably haven't done any recent development to have that thought.
Okay.
But it is essentially 50 feet as it travels north.
It's currently 50?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the retail to the east on the other side of Willow, nothing has been dedicated there either?
No, and I believe actually that's a parking lot, and then it becomes retail further to the east.
All right, and then my last, could you explain the difference between amenity space versus open space? Because if amenity, is that means there's going to be something happening there? But it looks like this is just mainly just green space. But can you just explain the difference,
please? It's mostly green space. And so amenity space or common open space or public open space, they're essentially all open space. But based on the zone that you develop in, it becomes labeled slightly different. And there's in Chapter 59, it allows certain things to be located or requires a certain size for that space. But because this is split zoned, the NR zone actually requires amenity open space, and the CRT zone requires public open space. And so we made the footnote that in the development table that it will be amenity open space just for consistency purposes.
Okay, great. And then last, I applaud the applicant or as part of this whole approval process of, you know, taking up some of the asphalt and creating more permeable space there. That's really great. So will the remaining part of the parking lot be resurfaced, or is it going to just stay like it is? Just out of curiosity.
I can let the applicant answer.
Oh, yeah. And I forgot to let the applicant give a presentation if they like. So why don't we do that, and then we'll go back to other board members' comments, okay?
Sure. Hi. Good morning. Chris Rulin with the law firm of Lurch, Early & Brewer. We have a couple of members of the project team here with us, and I'll let Patrick Horgan, who's to my right, answer this question. But I would say that we agree with the staff's recommendations. We think that this has been a thorough analysis and adequately captures all of this. We aren't planning to make a presentation. We're happy to answer any questions that anyone has. But why don't we start with this parking lot question?
Good morning to the board and planning staff. My name is Patrick Horgan with Huskin Horgan Engineering, with a civil engineer who prepared the site plan and subdivision waiver. So to answer your question, we on the site plan is proposing new pavement markings, but it's not explicitly proposing new asphalt. I think that will probably be up to the applicant during construction if they think it's worth it to mill and overlay it to make it look nicer.
Great. Well, let me let the other board members provide comments or questions.
Okay, a quick question. So the height is the height restriction is part of the Tacoma Park East Silver Spring overlay zone. What was the original purpose of that, and why 30 feet? That is really low. I mean, other than the obvious of not having things like this happen.
I can make some
suppositions are fine. Your professional opinion is good, Noah.
Well, so the overlay zone, it sets minimum or maximum height to 30 feet and then additional height up to 42 feet with planning board approval. So I think that essentially it was just ensuring that there's an extra step for compatibility for those structures, mm-hmm. given that it's located within the historic district and that area of Tacoma Park.
Yeah, in the historic district is the, thank you for very nice response. And the reason that we can't do an administrative subdivision requirement is the historic district aspect of putting the two lots together. Like that can't be done in an administrative approval?
No, unfortunately, when you look at the subdivision regulations where it breaks down preliminary plan, administrative plan, and minor, the criteria is really favorable towards residential properties and residential zones, unfortunately not so much for commercial properties.
Yeah. This is bigger than a ZTA, I think, Artie. This is more than needs to be done for a non-conforming 5 feet in a place that somebody wants to redo adaptive reuse. I agree that this is definitely put it on the parking lot for fixing through some sort of method. That's more than a ZTA because you've got this is several overlying things all intended to stop stuff from happening. So I think this one's bigger than just a small ZTA, but I'm glad you guys found a way to make this work.
So my question is that, is the applicant done? Do they have to come back to us, or can they just go get the building permit and build what they plan to build?
They will still be required to record the record plat that formally shows the lots 1 and 2 consolidated.
Yeah, I understand that, but there is no other preliminary plan or anything to come in front of us. Okay, good. Congratulations. Oh, sorry about coming here, but...
And I would just like to commend the owner and your team for taking the risk to create something in the community and preserve the building that is there. You're going to be an asset and a benefit to the community for a long time. So congratulations.
Commissioner Linden, any questions, comments?
No, nothing for me. Yeah, thanks for the presentation. Just to, echo what Commissioner Hedrick said about kind of the complexity of the needless complexity of this kind of application. No additional questions.
Great. So we have a couple of votes to take. First, we need to approve the subdivision waiver and the site plan, and then we can have to have another vote for approving the resolution. So we're going to do that's a little bit different today. So, So do I have a motion to approve with conditions the Sangfroid Distillery subdivision waiver and the site plan?
We have to take two, apparently, votes. We can do those. Okay. Move to approve the subdivision waiver and the site plan.
Second.
Second.
Okay. Moved and second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. 5-0. And do I have a motion to approve the to adopt the resolution that was in the package for this project?
Yeah. Move to adopt the resolutions as well.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Savitt. So thank you so much. Looking forward to you moving forward. I walk by this project every day and want to make sure it happens. Thank you so much. Yeah. All right. So we're going to just take a two-minute break, a real two-minute break, and start with our next item. Item 6, Travilla Road, conditional use and preliminary plan, where staff is recommending approval with conditions and also transmitting comments to the hearing examiner. Thank you. Good morning. We're on item number 6, Travilla Road, conditional use CU 2023-10 and preliminary plan number 1-2025-0100 and forest conservation plan number F 2025-0360, where staff is recommending 1, to submit comments on the conditional use to the hearing examiner supporting the conditional use petition, and on the preliminary plan and the forest conservation plan approving with conditions. So this morning we have Mark Beal with the planning department presenting this item. Welcome, Mr. Beal.
Good morning, thank you. For the record, Mark Beal, Up County Planning Division. Today, yes, I bring you the conditional use preliminary plan and forest conservation plan for Travilla Senior Living. Conditional use number is CU 202310. The preliminary plan number is 12025-0100. And the forest conservation plan is F 2025-0360. So we have three applications with this, as you mentioned. We have the conditional use for the use itself for independent living facility, and then we have the preliminary plan for the subdivision and platting, and then we have our final forest conservation plan. The board last year in July adopted a policy to be able to run concurrent reviews with these. I may be wrong, this may be the first one you've seen, I'm not quite sure, so let's have some fun. So the subject property is at 13741 and 13751 Travilla Road. The properties to the north are zoned R200 TDR3, and the properties to the east, south, and west are all zoned RE2. And staff found two other special exceptions on the abutting properties here and here. So the subject property consists of 10.75 acres and consists of three parcels. Just to clarify something, I know I had two addresses, but there's three parcels. Two of the addresses are under the same address, or two of the parcels are under the same address, just to clarify. One of the parcels has an existing landscape contractor horticultural nursery, and the area has some forest streams and a wetland area. So the applicant is proposing a new entrance in this location on Travilla Road, and they will be constructing independent living facility for seniors using a townhouse type construction, and the applicant is providing open spaces and amenity spaces here and throughout here for the new residents of the community. So for the conditional use side of it, it's meeting all the application is meeting all the standards for the conditional use for independent living facility, which includes access to public transportation, medical facilities, retail, and community services. So in our little map over here, the yellow is the subject property. The little white star is actually a bus stop, which is just a few hundred feet away. The green is community center. It's the Nancy Dasick Community Center. And then your little blue spots up here are your retail centers. And then the red is a whole lot of medical known as Life Science Center. The applicant is proposing to meet the maximum height. They're actually providing 60% green space, and they're only required to have 50% green space. And the setbacks are per the R30 standards as defined in the independent living facility conditional use requirements. So for the preliminary plan, we're looking at the subdivision of the 60 lots in platting, associated HOA parcels for the private streets, alleys, open spaces, that sort of thing. And they're meeting all standards of the zone, development standards for the zone and the use itself. So all noticing requirements have been met. The applicant had a pre-application meeting on March 4th of this year, and staff has not received any correspondence from anyone in the community. The property is located in the 2002 Potomac Subregion Master Plan. One of the three parcels was actually called out in the master plan, saying that it was an existing horticultural nursery landscape contractor, and it suggests that it gets changed to a residential use, which this application will do. The other two parcels were not called out specifically in the zoning ordinance, the fire department access plan, unapproved stormwater management concept plan. As you're aware, senior living doesn't generate school-age children, so there's no effect on the schools. And the applicant previously had an approved water and sewer category change, so it will be on public water and public sewer. for transportation, as I mentioned before, the applicant's providing a new driveway entrance off of Trevilla Road. They're providing their share of dedication along Trevilla Road to be able to create a 70-foot public right-of-way. The applicant's transportation exemption statement shows a maximum of 15 peak hour trips, and therefore there's no further LATR required. The applicant will be constructing a 6-foot sidewalk with a 9-foot street buffer and an 8-foot tree panel along the subject property frontage. And the applicant will be extending the frontage beyond the frontage, will be extending the sidewalk beyond the frontage to go to that little star I showed you to this, bus stop. And the applicant will be providing a crosswalk across Trevilla Road to get to the side path across the street. So there's a forest conservation plan that was submitted with this. The use category is medium residential development, which results in a 20% afforestation threshold and a 35% conservation threshold. There's a net tract area of 11 acres, and the applicant is meeting all afforestation and conservation requirements on site. So they're required to have 1.8 acres of forest planting. The applicant will be removing 0.04 acres of forest. The applicant will then be planting 2.15 acres of forest. All existing forested stream valley buffers will remain intact, and any unforested areas will be planted. The applicant will be placing 2.959 acres into a Category 1 conservation easement. You can see in the green area here. And then there was a tree request, a tree variance request with this application. The applicant will be removing 18 specimen trees, and the applicant has met all the findings to grant a variance for the tree variance, and they will be planting 50 3-inch caliper trees, as you can see in the little green circles around the property. So staff is recommending that the planning board makes a approves a recommendation with conditions to the hearing examiner for a independent living facility conditional use, as well as staff is recommending the board approve the preliminary plan, as well as we're recommending that you approve the final forest conservation plan. Thank you for your time, and we're here if you have any questions, as well as the applicant.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Beal, for your presentation. And would the applicant like to make a presentation?
Thanks. For the record, Scott Wallace with Miles and Stockbridge. With me is Pat Burns with CHI, the developer, and Josh Sloan with VICA, the civil engineering consulting team. And we don't have any presentation. Staff's presentation was very thorough, as always, and we are in agreement with all of the conditions of approval for the preliminary plan plus the recommendations for the conditional use application. So we're really just here to answer questions. We do have one clarification, which regards the bus, with regard to the bus stop. As Mark pointed out, there is a bus stop within 100 feet, and the initial proposal was to extend the sidewalk. My understanding is that DOT, though, has determined that there's not enough right-of-way in that location for the bus stop, for the sidewalk or the bus stop.
Yeah, so this is Josh Sloan with VICA. The actual bus stop, the sign itself is on somebody's private yard. There's no dedicated right-of-way on that. And so they've actually asked us to move the bus stop into our frontage and provide a landing. And that's in their letter. It just has not gotten caught up with the drawings. Right. But we'll make that in the certified set.
And we can accommodate that on our site with the dedication. So it is better. There just won't be the extension of the sidewalk, but the bus stop is in a good place for them. So that, again, my understanding, that's from DOT's letter of recommendation. So it's acceptable to us. I just wanted to clarify that.
Is it acceptable to staff?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Any questions or comments from the board? Okay, please.
This is a fantastic project, I should say. I'm very familiar with that plot, area. And it's true, it's really needed to have something like this, because something like this doesn't exist. I'm curious, when you say independent senior living, what age are we referencing to? What is the age limit?
It's 62 and above.
62 and above, yeah. Okay. And when I was reading the packet, this is nothing on site for the residents. So these are just townhouses for sale, And there is no other services that require staff there, correct?
Correct. And
go ahead.
I was going to say that's part of a relatively recent text amendment that acknowledged that senior living, 62 and older, can be accommodated in a variety of different forms of buildings and
yes.
not necessarily with services.
Yes. But it is accessible.
But with accessibility to...
So these townhouses, they have elevators?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, that's important. I think that's important that people have to hear that. So that's good. And I saw that you have at the south section, it's the forest. Is there any kind of natural path? Because that would be the best thing for the independent senior living, that to have some natural path just to walk in the forested area. Is there any kind of natural path you plan to have, or is it a possibility to have that?
We don't have any planned natural path within the forest conservation area. What we did instead is a loop road that comes down and goes along the edge of the forest, and that will have trees along it, so it'll be shaded. So you can walk down right next to the stream valley buffer in the forested area, but no path that goes into the easement area.
Okay. Is it steep that is not possible
no.
that people...
No, it is quite steep. Once you get to the stream valley buffer, it goes down 30% roughly, and we have to conserve some existing forest. So we made sure that the path that goes by and the seating areas that are associated with it are all accessible.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions before I ask mine? Okay, so just like also a bit curious, is there a reason why it's just not, no age-restricted townhomes? Is it because
The zoning.
Okay, yep. So you're fitting the needle, the string through the needle.
That's why we're going through conditional use. It's a conditional use. There's without that, you couldn't get the density.
Okay, great. Great.
Makes sense.
Great, thank you. And just also in the past, typically you could get more than 6 units per acre in townhomes, but is it because of the forest there? I mean, generally you would think you would get more density in a site 10 acres, but just out of curiosity, is there what preventing more?
In part, the size of the units.
Okay.
This will be a product that is appealing to folks maybe moving from a larger house, but it has to be a fairly large unit, so it's 24-foot units.
Okay.
But there's also, it's a significant open green space requirement on site. That's a limiting factor. That's the balance you pay that you for the density for the conditional use. There's a fairly significant open space requirement.
Okay, so if it weren't conditional use, if it was by right, I mean, there's a different green space requirement or something.
I'll just quickly say the building type is actually not allowed by the zone, if not for the fact that it's a conditional use, which is going to be age restricted. So we wouldn't be talking about townhouse development on this property per the zone to begin with. Okay. I just want to make that.
I understand. I'm just asking. But it's because of the zone, the conditional use, you have to have a higher.
And then the green, yes, the open space requirement that goes along with this conditional use is creating, they're meeting the minimum requirements of the open space to qualify for the conditional use. So, yeah.
Okay. I just wanted,
for
my education, why? Because apparently you can get more than 10 units, I mean, more than 6 units an acre. Okay, thank you. So those are my comments. I'm glad that you were able to find a way to make housing work here, and looking forward to, for the project moving forward. So if there are no other comments or questions, I think we'll do 3 motions here. Approvals, one, there's a motion to transmit comments to the hearing examiner supporting the conditional use petition.
I move to transmit comments to the hearing examiner supporting conditional use.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 The ayes have it, 5-0. Is there a motion to approve the preliminary plan where staff is recommending approval with conditions, including the additional change of where the bus stop is located?
Yeah. Move to approve the preliminary plan with the bus stop addition.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Ayes have it, 5-0. And lastly, is there a motion to approve the forest conservation plan where staff is recommending approval with conditions?
Yeah.
That's it.
Oh, yeah, move to approve the forest conservation plan. I got to move it first, then we can say.
I know, I'm so excited to get this
Let's just both second it. We'll do it all together. I will move just to make sure that that's clear.
I second.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
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 The ayes have it 5-0.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And one editorial comment. The process of being able to do concurrent review of preliminary and conditional use is excellent. That saved, I don't know, 8-10 months to have it, when it was sequential. So that's a process change that is really great, and appreciate the folks who made it happen.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, yeah, it's all about making it faster and less expensive for the applicant. And we'll also tell council that you said that that was a great thing.
That's I know, but did you take some kind, because I noticed that I didn't ask the question because I was asking too many. Did you take some risk on doing that? Because it's when you put all of this, because I was saying that what you knew that the conditional use would go.
Yes.
Okay.
There's similar comments that you would have gotten from both, so I think there's not a significant
So
risk.
It was no risk on your not part. In this particular Wonderful. Case. Yep. Just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, nine thank months you. Is a big saving, so thank you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you, staff.
Thank Great. You.
All right. So we're going to take a 2-minute break and start. So how long are we going to? Oh, we're early. Oh, wow. Okay. Okay, so we're, thanks everyone for attending this morning. We're adjourning our planning board hearing for today, and we will return around 11:30 with our next item presentation and discussion on single stair construction. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next week. Thank you.